Okay, I'll speak up. I'm sorry. This is my first time at doing this, so I'm a little bit nervous. Okay, now can you hear me? Now? How's this? This? Okay. How about this? Anyway, the paper again is Correlation, the Boring of a Generation by Clay Chandler, who is an architect and lifetime member who occasionally will sleep through sacrament meeting. He is from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Responding to his paper will be Albert Peck, the editor of Sunstone. And with that, let's go.
Well, I hope you'll be able to hear me. I got on a plane last night and flew in from Philadelphia. I got on a plane in Atlanta, and I was sitting next to a member of the church from Orem, who was on his way home to from Boston, where he'd been training all week. And I had a person in the plane turn around and tell me to be quiet. So if I was that loud on a plane, he told me I was shouting in his ear. So hopefully you'll all hear me. I've given myself a difficult task today, namely to provide an interesting dissertation on the subject of boredom. Since you're here of your own free will, I can only assume that you are either a connoisseur of fine boredom, or you're tired of being bored, or you were out late last night and thought this might be a good session to sleep through. With apologies to those in the last category, who I hope to keep awake, I'd like to start by relating to you a dream that I recently had. In my dream, I was sitting in a vaguely familiar academic setting. Judging from the signs on the wall and by the fact that I couldn't get my knees under the desk, I determined I was in an elementary school classroom. At first, I thought it must be parent-teacher conference at my daughter's school. But in looking around, I noticed that the desks were filled with students, not parents. The teacher was busy writing on a blackboard, which was covered with simple math problems. Most of the students appeared to be fourth or fifth graders, but a few, like me, had reached adulthood. One adult leaned over, whispered softly to a young boy seated nearby. The boy responded by returning his pencil around and erasing something he had just written. Another adult in the back row had apparently nodded off to sleep. Eventually, the teacher turned around, and to my astonishment, I recognized the face of Mrs. Silver, my fifth grade math teacher. It was she that taught me how to multiply and divide and has sparked in me a lifelong interest in math. I raised my hand. Mrs. Silver, I don't know what I'm doing here, but it is wonderful to see you again. She looked at me. Don't be silly, Clay. You're here because you're supposed to be here. You're here today just like you have been every week for the last 30 years. Now, please, give me the answer to the problem. She pointed to the numbers she had just written. 347 minus 206. I studied the board for a moment and then spoke. 101. She nodded appreciatively and turned to write another problem on the board. I continued. I'm sorry, Mrs. Silver, but you must be mistaken. I haven't been coming here for 30 years. After your class, I went on to other classes. I studied geometry and algebra, and then trigonometry, followed by college algebra and analytical geometry, and finally calculus. You're the one that got me started. Now, don't talk foolishness, Clay. You know the school board won't allow us to teach those things. In this class, we just teach the basics: addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. We teach one subject each year, and when we're done with the last one, we go back to the first and start over. We couldn't possibly teach all those other subjects. But Mrs. Silver, I promise you, I really did learn them, although I can't remember any of my calculus. Well, she smiled fleetingly. Well, if you did, you learned them at home on your own. Here at school, we have a very precise curriculum. Why, if we were to teach those things like algebra and calculus, it would be devastating to these young minds. We're not even allowed to teach negative numbers. I scanned the problems on the board. Not a negative number in the lot. But Mrs. Silver, I know all about negative numbers, I said. I even know about imaginary numbers and equal and opposite angles and second derivatives. Now, Clay, don't get us talking about the mysteries of math. I just want to make sure that everyone can balance their checkbook. I think that's wonderful, Mrs. Silver, but some of us want to learn more. And who do you think is going to pay for all those textbooks? No, it's better to just stick with the basics, not confuse everybody with outlandish theorems. Suddenly I was awakened from my dream by my wife's fingernails, which were now embedded in my side. I was back in sacrament meeting. A very monotone high counselor was speaking into the microphone. My wife, now that she had my attention, whispered, "You're setting a bad example for your children." "I'm not the only one," I replied and pointed to the stand where the bishop, chin pinned to his chest, was sound asleep. Well, those of you still awake have probably guessed that this story is fictional. I've never seen my bishop with his chin pinned to his chest. My bishop, like most good Mormons, has developed the ability to sleep while sitting bolt upright. Actually, what he's got is he's got the Mormon nod. It's... And if you really develop it to a skill, it looks as though you're nodding appreciatively, almost like an amen. Well, I use this story to make a point. Why do intelligent people who would never dream of taking the same math class or college course twice, why are they willing to sit in Sunday school classes, priesthood classes, Relief Society classes, and sacrament meetings, and listen to the same lessons and talks week after week, year after year? Why do we do it? Why? Because we are faithful church-going members, and because the correlation department of the church tells us what we will study and when. Prior to correlation, each of the auxiliaries were responsible for their own curriculum and manuals. Each typically brought out a new course of study every year. Some of the best scholars in the church were actively involved in the writing of new manuals, and their names were prominent on the covers. Some manuals were better than others, but most were intended to foster discussion and to motivate. What they were not was boring. Then in 1960, a revolution was begun that changed all the standard operating procedures. It began with the correlation of all manuals, which suddenly became anonymous documents written by committees. But it didn't stop there. Correlation has, for more than a generation, been actively involved in reshaping the organization and progress and programs of the church. In fact, over the last 30 years, no other committee or group has had a greater influence on the church than has correlation. My presentation today will focus on the growth and development of correlation, the changes it has created, and the impact those changes have had on the members of the church. Most of the information I will present comes from officially correlated church publications, such as the Ensign and Church News, but I was also able to interview two longtime correlation committee members who provided valuable insights into the workings of the committee. In order to encourage them to speak candidly, I guaranteed their anonymity. Correlation was the brainchild of Harold B. Lee. Introduced in 1960, its stated goal was to review the curricula of the auxiliary organizations and eliminate unnecessary duplication. Elder Lee's real objectives, however, went much further. His main concern was that the rapid growth predicted for the church in the coming years would lead to a loss of control and doctrinal dilution. During a conference talk given in 1967 on the subject of correlation, Lee shared some growth projections that had been done by the Department of Statistics at Brigham Young University. They predicted that the church would grow from 443 stakes and nearly 4,000 wards and branches in 1967 to 1,000 stakes and nearly 10,000 wards by 1985, with a total membership of between 5.7 and 7.7 million. These numbers, in retrospect, were fairly accurate. He then asked the following questions. How can we best provide the necessary leadership with enough worthy, able leaders in the right places at the right time? How can we best finance a kingdom of this scope and dimension? How can we best absorb, fellowship, and teach this many souls? His concerns were real, and to his credit, he was the first general authority to really focus on the problems that would be caused by exponential growth. And another of his major concerns was for the family. He felt that societal changes would make the family as an institution vulnerable to attack. The family unit, he said, should be considered the integral unit in the church. Apostle Boyd K. Packer, who has been involved with correlation since its early days, once said, quote, "There was a certainty at the beginning of the correlation that we were moving into some major societal changes, and the institution of the family would be under attack. But we were tooled up in anticipation of that, and correlation was putting the institutionalized church as a servant of the doctrine of the church," unquote. We took it one step further and described correlation as, quote, "a consolidation of the forces of the Lord to meet the forces of evil," unquote. Lee's third major area of concern was the auxiliaries. Prior to 1960, the auxiliary organizations of Relief Society, Primary Sunday School, and the Young Men's and Young Women's Mutual Improvement Associations had been relatively autonomous. Lee felt strongly that all auxiliaries not only needed to cooperate better, but that they also needed to be brought under the direct control of the priesthood. He once said that he wanted to, quote, "bring the priesthood back where it should be, according to Revelations, and then determine the relationship of the auxiliaries to the priesthood," unquote. The Correlation Committee was originally organized with 7 members of the 12 and the presiding bishop named as the Correlation Executive Committee. The first presidency and the entire Council of the 12 Apostles made up the actual Correlation Committee, and still do today. Three subcommittees were then formed: the Children's Correlation Committee, the Youth Correlation Committee, and the Adult Correlation Committee, and one apostle was assigned to each committee. Elder Lee then brought in professionally trained experts who became key aides. Two such aides were Boyd K. Packer and Neil A. Maxwell, who were to play important roles in the development and growth of correlation. A special boardroom was established where all the changes were charted on the wall, and only committee members were allowed access. As they reviewed policy and procedures, 2 overriding principles guided these 3 subcommittees. First, they were to simplify and eliminate duplication. And second, they were to make sure that the priesthood was firmly in control. The adult committee's first major recommendation was that the ward or block teaching program be changed to home teaching. The new emphasis would be on strengthening the family through the priesthood. The father was to be recognized as the patriarch of each household, and the home teachers were specially appointed priesthood representatives who were to teach their families the fundamentals of parental responsibility instead of just delivering a gospel message. They were also to assess the spiritual and material welfare of each family. Their assessment information was then to be taken to the ward's priesthood executive committee, another new committee instituted by correlation. The original name proposed for home teaching was the Priesthood Watchman. But that name was discarded when President David O. McKay suggested that he didn't want the membership to think of the priesthood as detectives. Meanwhile, the Children's Correlation Committee was working on a plan of their own. The primary organization had suggested that they wanted to have families help reinforce the lessons being taught in primary. Their plan was to send notes home with the children each week so that the parents could have follow-up discussions. The Children's Committee decided this whole process was backwards. If the family was the fundamental unit of the church, then the primary should be reinforcing the family's teachings and not the other way around. This, of course, would require that the families actually teach in the home. And if the primary were to reinforce those teachings, well, then that would require some kind of a correlated manual. So they wrote one, and Family Home Evening was born. That first year, 650,000 manuals were printed and distributed with a lesson for every week. Each year's theme was correlated between the Family Home Evening, Melchizedek Priesthood, and Relief Society lessons. And initially, the Sunday School General Board instituted a special class to aid parents in their Family Home Evening preparation. Family Home Evening's original name was Home Teaching, and the Children's Committee was disappointed when the Adult Committee took the name first. Eventually, the Children's Committee was dissolved, and it became the Family Home Evening Committee, and it functioned as the Family Home Evening Committee for over 15 years. The Youth Committee centered its efforts on consolidating functions between MIA, Sunday School, and seminary. MIA was given responsibility for socializing and physical activities. The name was eventually changed to Activity Night, and the Mutual Improvement Association part of the name was officially dropped. Seminary and Sunday School were directed to concentrate on teaching, and with a few exceptions, to avoid social activities. These changes were prompted by Lee's belief that each auxiliary, independently and individually, felt the responsibility, the entire responsibility, for the welfare of their charges, and that unnecessary duplication was the result. In one of the conversations I had with a longtime correlation committee member, I was informed that Lee was also, quote, dead against scouting, unquote. Lee attempted to eliminate scouting and replace it with a program specifically designed to help young men prepare for the priesthood, but was unsuccessful, partly due to his premature death and partly due to strong resistance from other apostles. For decades, the Boy Scouts of America has courted general authorities, given them honors and medals, in order to maintain scouting's strong position within the church. The power of the Correlation Committee grew rapidly, and its initial objectives of reviewing curricula became just one of their many activities. Speaking in 1961, just the year after correlation was officially started, Lee said that adoption of correlation will help, quote, consolidate and simplify church curriculum, church publications, church buildings, church meetings, and other aspects of the work, unquote. His reference to church buildings and church meetings indicates that almost from the very beginning, he was thinking about such things as standardized building plans and the consolidated meeting schedule. Most of these changes were made gradually so to as avoid upsetting the membership. In 1964, Lee warned, "You've seen it being unraveled bit by bit, and you will see and hear more of it." He was right. By the mid-60s, the Correlation Committee had quietly become a major source of power within the church. The three subcommittees were given broad latitude to question all of the policies, procedures, and practices of the church, everything except the doctrine. Lee made it clear on many occasions that the doctrines of the church could not be changed except by revelation. As part of the questioning process, Lee brought in two consulting firms who were hired to examine the church's administrative procedures. One reform they suggested resulted in the creation of the Department of External Communications, which later became the Public Communications Department. Another suggestion led to the creation of the Division of Internal Communications, which was put in charge of producing and reviewing all the instructional materials and communications from church headquarters to the members. This division later became the Correlation Review Committee, and it is currently one of the major subcommittees operating within Correlation. Its responsibilities have expanded to include reviewing, quote, all proposed programs, activities, plans, and terminology, and such items as handbooks, courses of study, magazines, general correspondence, and audiovisual materials, to ensure that they are correct doctrinally and that they are consistent with approved policies, teachings, programs, and activities, both within and between church departments and organizations, unquote. Even general authorities talks are heavily screened, and statements considered to be even the slightest bit controversial are censored. This has not traditionally been the case, but is the case now. Another major subcommittee is the Research and Evaluation Department, which, quote, evaluates the effectiveness of church programs, materials, activities, policies, and procedures to determine how well they serve their intended purpose in helping proclaim the gospel, perfect the saints, and redeem the dead. The division responds to requests to conduct research from general authorities and from church departments and organizations. It coordinates all church research projects and ensures that the research is conducted independently and objectively, unquote. Those last two quotes were taken from an Ensign article that was talking about the actual responsibilities of those two committees. Now, as I wrote this paper, those were the two major committees that I knew about. But a reference should be made here to a third subcommittee of correlation, which is in the cover of today's Salt Lake Tribune, and needs to be mentioned. It was mentioned earlier, and those of you, I flew in yesterday, so those of you who have been here for the last few days know a lot more about it than I do. The name of this committee does not appear anywhere in official church publications, nor was it mentioned during any of my interviews with correlation members, but its existence was acknowledged yesterday by church spokesman Don LeFevre. It's the Strengthening the Church Members Committee. I knew that a committee must exist to review statements of members that were deemed to be threatening to the organization or deemed to be statements that could possibly hinder the mission of the church. I knew of its existence because I've seen it in action with with dear friends and people I care about. It never had a name before. It has a name now. Correlation survived Lee's death in 1973 and continued to promote change. In addition to the changes already mentioned, stake and general conference formats were revamped. Area conferences were created. A consolidated meeting schedule was instituted. Regional representatives were appointed, and the position of assistant to the Council of the Twelve was replaced by the first quorum of the 70. The auxiliaries, of course, were affected the most by all of these changes. Their lesson materials were rewritten, censored, and brought into conformity with the goals of the review division. More important, however, was the fact that the priesthood was now firmly in control. Hardest hit was the Relief Society, which lost control of its buildings, its magazine, its manuals, and especially its finances. The Relief Society had always supported itself independently through various fundraising activities such as bazaars and raffles. Parenthetically, I find it interesting to... I didn't realize until my mother pointed out to me that the Relief Society used to have raffles, and I find it interesting that in one of the two states in the nation that doesn't even have a state lottery, that the Relief Society was sponsoring raffles. While Lee was busy orchestrating correlation, N. Eldon Tanner was at work revitalizing the church's finances. Bringing the relatively wealthy Relief Society into the organization went a long way towards improving the church's balance sheet. In his 1967 talk on correlation, Lee directly referenced the auxiliaries and what he intended to do. As justification, he read the following statement made by Joseph F. Smith in 1906, a statement Lee claimed was prophetic. Quote, "We expect to see the day, if we live long enough, and if some of us do not live long enough to see it, there are others who will, when every council of the priesthood in the Church of Latter-day Saints will understand its duty, will assume its own responsibility, will magnify its calling and fill its place in the Church to the uttermost, according to the intelligence and ability possessed by it. When that day shall come, there will not be so much necessity for work that is now being done by the auxiliary organizations, because it will be done by the regular quorums of the priesthood. The Lord designed and comprehended it from the beginning, and he has made provision in the church whereby every need may be met and satisfied through the regular organizations of the priesthood. It has truly been said that the church is perfectly organized. The only trouble is that these organizations are not fully alive to the obligations that rest upon them. When they become thoroughly awakened to the requirements made of them, they will fulfill their duties more faithfully, and the work of the Lord will be all the stronger and more powerful and influential in the world." Unquote. Lee went on to stress the emphasis correlation was placing on teaching and greater parental responsibility, and he said, "Much of what we do organizationally, then, is scaffolding as we seek to build the individual." Lee clearly was pointing to the day when all auxiliaries would be eliminated. Lee was not the first general authority who tried to wrestle control from the auxiliaries, but he was the first to succeed. Previous attempts had always ended in failure as the auxiliaries fought back and various defenders among the general authorities came to their aid. Lee was successful because he convinced the auxiliaries that they could no longer be fully independent. Instead, they needed to coordinate and correlate their activities with others. Once the auxiliaries felt that sense of shared responsibility, it was easy to pull them all underneath the priesthood umbrella. In one of my interviews, it was pointed out that some of the, quote, empires are still there, but they have been weakened. The brethren are careful not to crush the presidencies of the auxiliaries, unquote. He then cited an example. Correlation had suggested that the auxiliaries should consolidate their in-service programs. Correlation's idea was to call an in-service instructor to teach all the auxiliaries on a monthly basis. The priesthood, Relief Society, young men, young women, and some of the primary teachers would attend the in-service lessons during Sunday school. During Sunday school time, the hour when they would not be teaching. And the Sunday school and the rest of the primary teachers would attend in service during the time reserved for priesthood and Relief Society. When this plan was presented, the young men's and women's organizations were enthusiastic. The Relief Society reluctantly agreed, but the primary absolutely refused. They said that they had a good in-service program and that their in-service teachers were far more capable of helping their teachers deal with the special needs of primary-age children. The primary steadfastly refused to participate, and eventually correlation backed off. The Quorum of the Twelve and the First Presidency could have insisted, but eventually bowed to the primary's wishes. He also went on to say to me that he thinks that that will eventually be correlated. It's just a matter of time. By 1980, the Correlation Committee felt that most of the work that Harold B. Lee had intended was done. A Church News article that year praised correlation by quoting N. Eldon Tanner, who had once said, quote, "Priesthood correlation is the closest blueprint yet in mortality to the plan presented in the Grand Council in Heaven before the world was created," unquote. They were clearly pleased with their creation. New problems were emerging, however. New emphasis was being placed on translations. In 1979, there was 57 authorized languages. By 1984, there would be 96. New languages not only meant new translations of the scriptures, but also of all the manuals. The Correlation Committee was sent back to their planning boards with the assignment to simplify, simplify, simplify. The result was a revised LDS curriculum consisting of the Holy Scriptures and 49 courses. 11 courses are for children, 22 for youth, and 18 for adults. Smaller units of the church have a curriculum which consists of the scriptures and 7 manuals. As these units grow, more manuals are added. The decision was also made to recycle lesson manuals every 4 years. The adult gospel doctrine class studies the Old Testament, New Testament, Book of Mormon, and church history in successive years and then repeats. The Melchizedek priesthood manuals were then correlated to the gospel doctrine manuals, and they also repeat every 4 years. In 1989, it was announced that the Relief Society manuals would also be brought into the four-year system. Nowhere is there a clearer explanation given as to the reason for these changes than was given by Joanna B. Doxey, second counselor in the Relief Society presidency, who said that the change was necessary, quote, "so that the church translation, production, and printing departments are more free to help flood the earth with copies of the Book of Mormon," unquote. That same year, 1989, at a regional representative seminar, a number of talks were given indicating that correlation was entering into a new phase. Marvin J. Ashton of the Council of the Twelve spoke of using the priesthood and auxiliaries to bring back the inactive, and said that we could do this without, quote, "new programs, new meetings, or new policies," unquote. Neil A. Maxwell, also of the Council of the Twelve, said, "We do not need new programs, new organizations, and meetings. We do need a new focus on the mission of the church." And then Marion D. Hanks of the presidency of the First Quorum of the 70 said, "Our emphasis is on individuals rather than on the traditional approach on programs." My interviews revealed that this no new program phase lasted only a few years and ended approximately 12 months ago. Under the current system, all decisions regarding new programs must be made by the entire Correlation Committee consisting of all 12 apostles and the First Presidency. If they can be convinced that there's a need for a new program or manual, it may be possible, but you have to get permission to pursue it and permission to implement it. Caution is their watchword. In my interviews, I asked where correlation is headed today. I didn't learn of any new programs looming on the horizon, but I was told that they are preparing to spread the gospel to countries like China and India. The costs involved are staggering. And once again, relief is being sought through simplification. They have asked this fundamental question: what is essential to the gospel? And the response is that we absolutely need to have the scriptures, the ordinances, and temples. Three things that are not considered to be necessary are the auxiliaries, whose duties would ideally be assumed by the quorums, the manuals — the scriptures will be our manuals — and ward houses. The members can collect in neighborhoods and worship in people's homes. Or, as I was told in one of my interviews, quote, "wards are a Wasatch Front luxury," unquote. I was told that the same concern exists today that Harold B. Lee had in 1960, namely, having sufficient trained leaders, and the answer today is the same as it was then. Simplify. Get rid of all the fat and even the unnecessary muscle. Get right down to the bare bones. It's easier to develop leaders if there's less they need to know. There are other concerns as we become more of a global church. They worry that the people in the rest of the world will think that this is just an American church. There's concern about the cost of being a member, that the travel's expensive, that buying scriptures is expensive, that the time commitment is too large. For over 3 decades, the answer to all these questions has been to simplify, correlate, and consolidate. These steps may be necessary to deal with the influx of new members, but it also means that the longtime members, the Wasatch Front members, the intellectual community, and all the special interest groups that rely on the auxiliaries for help and support, and isn't that everyone, must suffer. Correlation was a revolution that seemed necessary in light of the enormous growth that the church has experienced. But like most revolutions, this one has gone too far. There is no Bill of Rights here to protect individuals from an oppressive government, for that's impossible in a theocracy where the individuals have no vote. Control, the number one goal of correlation. I'm not going to repeat that. Control was always the number one goal of correlation. Control of the auxiliaries, control of the finances, control of what we were studying, control of what was being taught, control of what was being said. That initial emphasis on control has now evolved into what Richard Paul has described as authoritarian conservatism. Paul makes the point that correlation was intended to eliminate the intellectual threat by eliminating intellectual inquiry from church education. He goes on to say that correlation is the, quote, primary contributor to the sense of isolation, even alienation, that many reflective Latter-day Saints feel in the church today. It could hardly be otherwise when official instructional programs in all church organizations are designed to inhibit thoughtful discussions, unquote. Any instructor in the church today would have a hard time disagreeing with this statement. The manuals tell you exactly what points to make, what questions to ask, and what answers to give. Interestingly, I was told in an interview that the Correlation Committee is currently putting a very strong emphasis on teaching by the Spirit. This will be necessary because the current manuals are going to be dramatically reduced in size. A seminary manual, which currently might provide as many as 50 pages of instruction for 1 week, may only have one page per week in the future. Providing one page of instructions per week is obviously cheaper than providing 50, but I find it difficult to believe that they will trust us to draw our own conclusions as to what the scriptures mean. A friend of mine was recently removed from a Sunday school position where he taught the 16-year-olds. He was removed for refusing to follow the course outlines in the manual. He was interviewed by the bishop several times prior to his release. I shouldn't actually say he was released. He was actually called to be the assistant ward clerk, a position which he declined. During one of those discussions, he asked the bishop, "Do you believe you were inspired to give me this calling?" And the bishop responded, "Yes, I do." He said, "Well, I believe you were inspired as well, and I want you to know that the Lord clearly knew I was not going to follow the manual." We are part of an entire generation that has been spoon-fed a sanitized, sterilized, and non-controversial gospel. Teaching by the Spirit means going where the Spirit leads you. I'm not sure that we know how to do it, and I fear that those who try will inevitably run into trouble with the more correlated members of the church. In my parable, I talked about continuing education. If the church can't or won't provide it, perhaps we as adults should gather on our own for that purpose. Isn't that why we're here today? My parents, for example, have belonged to a Mormon study group for over 40 years. Back then, study groups were abundant. Their group studied such books as The Articles of Faith, A Marvelous Work and a Wonder, The Faith of a Scientist by Henry Eyring, and The Comprehensive History of the Church. Study groups are not new, and their origin can be traced back as far as Kirtland. An intellectual tradition has always existed in this church, and study groups have traditionally provided a forum for intelligent conversation. They also, as evidenced by my parents, lead to valuable social interaction and lifelong friendships. Today's generation is skeptical, however, of anything that isn't officially sanctioned. I personally don't know anyone in my generation who belongs to a study group. Now, I'm sure that there are some out there, but I'm not aware of any. When I questioned a few people about this, I was told that some 20 years ago, study groups were officially disapproved of, in much the same way that symposia are now under attack. Correlation's main goal is control, and any uncorrelated gathering of adults, because it is beyond the church's control, will be viewed as a possible threat to us as individuals and, most importantly, to the organization. The more prominent the gathering, the more threatened the organization feels. A few years ago, I came here and spoke about the evolution of Mormon architecture. I reviewed the process of how we arrived at today's standardized business plan, building plans. I felt then, as I do now, that there is nothing wrong with standardization as long as what you standardize is, one, functional, and two, imparts a sense of reverence and worship in the members who use it. Unfortunately, the plans we have standardized don't do either. I worry that correlation is built upon an equally shaky foundation. Its solutions are too simplistic and are based too heavily on cost effectiveness. Lee's determination to strengthen the family was an admirable one, but he placed his faith in the ability of parents to teach their children in the home. On the whole, we parents, and this is just my opinion, on the whole, we parents don't do a great job of teaching our children at home. There are exceptions, and I know some wonderful families that do an excellent job, but most of us have a difficult time living up to their standards. Even the best parents recognize that our youth, and teachers in particular, need the added support provided by healthy auxiliaries if we expect our children to remain strong in the church. The auxiliary organizations weren't formed to create autonomous empires. They were formed because there was a need for them, and that need has grown, not diminished, over the years. When Joseph F. Smith predicted that the day would come when the auxiliaries would no longer be necessary because it would all be done by the regular quorums, perhaps he was referring to the day when women would receive the priesthood and become leaders in the quorums. Because we as men have, in my opinion, been dismal failures at assuming the responsibilities of the auxiliaries. We don't even perform home teaching the way it's supposed to be done. Plans to further simplify the organization and further diminish or eliminate the auxiliaries in the future are extremely dangerous, because it denies a premise that Joseph Smith, as the founder of Mormonism, knew only too well. The church is not just the gospel. The church is a community and a culture as well. Joseph Smith knew the importance of creating a community, as evidenced by the creation of Kirtland, Nauvoo, and later on by Salt Lake City. The Word of Wisdom, the United Order, polygamy, temples, and temple garments were all attempts to make us unique as a culture. But now Mormonism is starting to lose its unique cultural status. The United Order and polygamy are things of the past. Isolationism was given up with the driving of the Golden Spike. Medical science has caught up with the Word of Wisdom. From our political conservatism to our embracing of capitalism, more and more we are resembling a conservative, mainline Protestant church. Stripping the church down to the bare essentials in order to foster missionary work may be counterproductive if there is no culture or community left for the new members to be fellowshipped into. As much as I worry about the fate of new members, I am more concerned for those long-term members, Wasatch Front members, and intellectual members whose needs for personal growth are not being met. I, for one, gain little sitting in a priesthood class listening to lessons that I have heard numerous times from a teacher who has no idea how to teach by the Spirit and is afraid to bring in outside resource materials to enrich his lesson. But I keep going because I know that's where I'm supposed to be. Our gospel doctrine class consists of an assortment of old-time and new members, some with fragile testimonies, some with strong, intensive ones. It seems too logical to create another gospel doctrine class for people that want to increase their knowledge, but of course that would require a correlated manual, which would have to be created by a committee, which would take out anything controversial, and soon that new manual would look just like the old one, and it would be costly to translate and print it into all those different languages. My only alternatives are either to sidetrack the lesson by asking questions that the manual doesn't want asked and that the teacher hasn't been given answers for, or I can go to sleep, or, as I often do, I can open my scriptures and read quietly by myself. In my research, I ran across a statement from Boyd K. Packer that is particularly disconcerting. Packer is an extremely influential man in the church, and as one of Harold B. Lee's hand-chosen correlations assistants, he is one of correlation's biggest proponents. He spoke of the early years of correlation and how they were concerned largely with organization and programs and procedures. He then spoke of the threefold mission of the church and said that it is now time to move, quote, toward another kind of correlation, beyond the correlation of programs and procedures. It has more to do with implementation than planning. This is a correlation of spirit, of attitude. This correlation is in the mind, in the heart, and in the very soul, unquote. What God has placed in my heart is not correlation, but it is a desire and an ability to learn and to grow. How can we be told in the scriptures that the glory of God is intelligence and then internalize a system which denies intelligent inquiry? How can we be asked to stick with simple arithmetic when geometry and algebra and maybe even calculus are there for the learning? Thank you.
Really enjoyed Clay's paper, and throughout listening to it, and when I read it before, I kept always wanting to say yes and give personal examples to the points he was making, and on some occasions I wanted to say yes, but, and qualify what he said, but I think he's given us a good outline of the church, the reduction of the church that many of us have experienced or observed in the last 20 and 30 years. I think we need to put this in a larger historical perspective in the sense that the streamlining of the church is something that's been ongoing ever since we came to Utah. And it's not just the streamlining, but it's the systematizing. Joseph Smith did not leave us with a coherent, cohesive plan for running the church. I don't think that was his personality. I don't think it was his style. He'd set up quorums and everything were just all different. Were kind of uncoordinated and fragmented, and people were given independent, sometimes conflicting missions, as you see with the conflicts between the Patriarch and the Quorum of the Twelve and all the other different quorums that he created. During Brigham Young's time, as Dean Jesse's articles have shown, Brigham Young consistently tried to regularize what the quorums were about. And there have been regular priesthood reform movements throughout the church history. In the early part of the century, it was the standardization of what ages you became a deacon, teacher, priest, and how that evolved into being a youth program instead of primarily for adults in those priesthood offices. And so, in fact, the quote he quoted from Joseph Fielding Smith is a quote during a time of priesthood reform, where they're trying to once again make the quorums do the work of the church. So the priesthood correlation we've observed, as he noted, is one of the most successful attempts to get control of the church by the general authorities, to make it systematic, logical, organizational, and also, to some degree, to streamline our doctrines also in the process. As I was growing up, it seemed like the liberals in the church were always complaining about too many meetings and complaining about the manuals being too fat and telling us what to teach and giving us all too much material that we really didn't need and we could supplement on our own. And in the last few years, it seems that many liberals are complaining that we don't have enough meetings, and we have a nostalgia for all the auxiliaries that we no longer go to, and we're lamenting one-page lesson plans instead of longer ones. And I think there's reasons for that, but there's some irony there also. It was interesting. As a child, I remember growing up in the 60s, and then later in college, going back and reading the talks of David O. McKay, where he kept talking about the family being the most important thing and the importance of home teaching. And although they were very upfront about it, I don't think many people living in that time really had a sense of how this push on the family and home evening and home teaching was one component of a larger master plan which was being implemented. Certainly, the church that we think about today is very different from the church that Brigham Young would talk about. We talk about Zion, and for him, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints encompassed every aspect of everyone's life. Encompassed the social, the artistic, the intellectual, the educational, the political aspect of the life. So we just haven't seen the systemizing of the church, but we've seen the narrowing of what we consider to be the proper boundaries of the church. With a great accommodation, after 1890, we decided the church shouldn't be involved in political affairs, by and large. And but that side of the life, of our life, was something the church was not involved in. And it wasn't trying to no longer plan an entire society based upon our religious principles. And in these last decades, we've seen us define more and more of what the church is not in an attempt to say what we are. We are not going to try to meet everyone's artistic needs. We're not going to have dance festivals, and we're not going to have speech contest to teach us how to be public speakers, and we're not going to do all the sorts of things which I even experienced growing up as a youth. And there's some nostalgia for that, but I think there's also some very healthy things about that. One of the interesting things that is in Clay's paper is how the growth of the church, when we had to decide to accommodate, to the American culture, that decision made us redefine what the church is about. Now that we're having to seriously confront the issues of the international church and create a church that can be transplanted to foreign cultures, that is driving a major change in the church today. It's one of the main reasons it is because we have this notion that we have to have one plan that will work anywhere in the world. And since the plan which we have here cannot be transported to India, and they're right, then we have to cut back here, you know, so that we've got one manual that anyone can follow anywhere in the world. And so much of what we're seeing, from the consolidated meeting schedule to more and more cutting back, is being driven by the desire to address the needs of taking the church into developing countries. As that happens, what we control narrows. We don't try to control as much as we used to. And it's very interesting the things we pick to control. And to some degree, I think we're picking some of the less essential aspects. Although, as Clay pointed out, we try to control everything, doctrine, finance. But there's many things that we're just left to our own. You always hear people talking about correlation. But the key word is priesthood. It's priesthood correlation. It was to put the priesthood in control, as he said. People who lived in the auxiliaries in the 50s and 60s remember how all of the major auxiliaries had direct contact with the local stake auxiliaries, the relief societies, the young women's. They all wrote their manuals. They all wrote their memos. They all had these huge general boards who went out touring and had conferences and told everyone how to run their own conferences. What we did, we decided all information goes through priesthood channels, you know, from headquarters to regional representatives to stake presidents to bishops, and all the auxiliaries are funneled in under them. I think that was a legitimate attempt of the general authorities to get control of the church. I mean, they really believed that God gave them the keys to run the church, and without having some kind of organizational control, that they weren't running the church. And I think that was a genuine concern, and they addressed it very efficiently. It's unfortunate that the Relief Society was caught up in that. You know, Joseph Smith didn't talk about the Relief Society as an auxiliary. Calling the Relief Society an auxiliary the more recent phenomenon, and it would be more fortunate if the Relief Society was considered a quasi-priesthood quorum. So it was treated with more dignity. But it wasn't, and I don't think it was an intentional slight at the women. It was just treating them as yet another priesthood quorum. Non-priesthood quorum is an auxiliary. He mentioned at the end the three missions of the church. I think we need to recognize how crucial they have been to how we define what we're about as Mormons. To say that what we are about is to preach the gospel, to save our dead, and to perfect the saints is a too narrowing of what the richness of the gospel calls us to. And it allows us to too easily become self-righteous. There's a person is going on missions and sending out Book of Mormons and going to the temple and getting married in the temple, which is part of called perfecting the saints, means getting the ordinances for yourself and being active in the church. It's easy to say, I'm doing everything that's asked of me. And we're missing the true call to become a person of Christ and to incorporate the attributes and the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, to live a life of for peace and social justice, which those things just aren't there, and so we don't talk about them, and we don't design programs for them. And we're missing the aspect, some major aspects in the narrowing of our definition of Mormonism. One of the aspects of narrowingness is that the church isn't going to meet our needs. They say they're not going to meet our needs, but we have these incredible needs that need to be met. So we're seeing the growth of independent organizations like Sunstone. There's tons of other journals and publications and associations becoming organized in the same time that the church is doing correlation. From 1960 on, we have seen the multiplication of the independent organizations. I think that's healthy. I don't think I want to really be in a church that tries to meet all of my needs. But I don't, I'll get right to the end here. But I don't think, so I'm not really sure I want them to teach algebra in priesthood meeting. But I don't want to be taught 2+2 either. Because we've cut out all of the things that provided our social needs, we've left us with going to meetings where we sit and are talked to. And then we leave. And we're expected to do certain things on our own. There's very little social interaction from what there was before, which means the loss of religious community. I think that's fundamentally what religion is about. We are the people of God. We are the family of God. We need to be together to live and strengthen each other. We're losing that. I don't think that was an intentional loss. I think in all their tinkering with church programs and things, they assumed that community would always be there. But it won't be there. That's why we're organizing independent things. If we're going to streamline the church and get rid of so many programs and things, we need to restructure what we do with the remaining time. I think that means we need to, instead of having forums where we're only preached to and we sit there passively listening, our priesthood and Relief Society meetings need to be business meetings and organization meetings where we participate in collaboration and say, what are we about and what should we be doing? We should be doing service projects, and they should be where people are talking and participating and disagreeing and making decisions, you know, really be doing the business of the kingdom. And Sunday school should be discussions of gospel doctrines where there's genuine interchange and intercourse. And all of them should be a place where people come and feel safe as a saint, where they say, I am part of this people, and I come to church, and I share people's spiritual journeys, and we care, and we enjoy. But now we come and we feel like, if I reveal who I am, I get judged and I get excluded and people think bad of me. And we need to change our structure so that we come to church to celebrate. When I think of, in my romantic mind, of what the early Christians experienced when they would gather to church, they would live perhaps most of their day-to-day lives independent of their community. Yet on Sunday, they would gather together to partake of the Lord's Supper. And there, you might have a Roman centurion and a Jew in the diaspora and another convert and a rich person and some poor people, and they're all gathered in someone's home, partaking of the Lord's Supper and learning of each other's needs, sharing their spiritual journeys, sharing their burdens, helping each other carry their burdens, and they have that sense of community. Whether they are learning how to dance or play the piano or something, that's something in that. We need to define our religious experience at Sunday and in the church where we celebrate and cultivate the core aspects of Christianity. And I don't think they're really defined in the three missions of the church. I think they're more defined in 1 Corinthians 13 and in the Sermon on the Mount. And so I think we need to do restructuring. But personally, and so I think the algebra we need, I don't mind us having the same lessons again if they're on learning how to do Christian living and learning how to share each other's burdens and sharing each other's burdens. I think that's what religion should be about. And I think we should leave the calculus and algebra to independent forums, you know, where we don't have to worry about, is this official or is this right or is this not. And I'm really glad that one of the aspects of correlation is that we've kind of jettisoned a lot of the quirky things that were there in the Pioneer Church, you know, because we just don't want to have to translate them. I'm really glad about that. And it leaves us with a lot more freedom to explore the gospel in our time and in our age and with our cultural categories and to be genuine in who we are and not bound by all those things that they did in the Pioneer Church. And I celebrate that. And so there's good and bad in it. We need to rethink a lot of what we've done. Okay.
We only have a few minutes left. There is still some time for questions if anyone has any.
The Yeah.
Was that a question?
Yeah.
More of a comment. I agree with you. I would just say that if you take one thing away from this talk, it is the idea that the word correlation and control are virtually synonymous. And while I agree with Albert 100%, you know, let us deal with... Well, not 100%, right? I agree. I would like to be able to go to a quorum meeting where I was actually intellectually stimulated. And I remember that in the past. And so maybe I'm one of these people that's looking longingly back at the days when you could have conversations that were just more interesting. But on the other hand, I agree that the best forum for intellectual discussion is places like Sunstone. But as I pointed out, this meeting is out of the control of the general authorities, and they don't like it. They do not sanction independent gatherings of saints. And you know, there in old days, you used to be able to go to church, and there were long gaps. I mean, I grew up in Salt Lake. There were long gaps between meetings, and so you could stand around for an hour between priesthood and Sunday school and have gospel discussions. But now you go, you run to this meeting, run to that meeting, run to sacrament meeting, and you're gone. Plus, the halls are kind of crowded, so it's hard to stand around and talk anyway. So I miss that. I think there's more need for community, and I think there's more need for intellectual discussion. And you know, intellectual discussion is not going to be stamped out. You know, if you start putting pressure over here, it's going to pop up over there. It will always be there. And I would like to see the day when they just acknowledge it, or just ignore it. I'd accept either.
Let me say something about teaching by the Spirit, because they've really defined what they mean by that. They simplified the manuals, and they say we want people to have discussions and teach by the Spirit. But in interviews in the Ensign, they have said, here's the question you're supposed to ask. We are supposed to do such and such. Has anyone had an experience that illustrates that? And they confine what the Spirit is to the very little thing they want. And so there's no sense of spiritual journey. There's not saying, let's today talk about forgiveness, and people share their experiences and the things they've learned and expect there to be great diversity among it. They clearly define the outcome in the question, and so there's no sense of the Spirit coming forth from the congregation, which we really need to do. We need to value people's experiences and give them validity in terms of, if it's different from ours, let's share our journeys. And so we lose the Spirit in that sense.
A number of years, Paul Toscano's hymns for alternate voices started circulating around before they were in book form, and I have been inspired by him on a number of occasions. And my favorite hymn that I ever wrote dealt with this topic, and I just have to tell you, I'm a closet hymn writer, but I'm coming out of the closet. This is a hymn to be sung to the tune of Again We Meet Around the Board. I'm not going to sing because I'm too nervous, but it goes like this. Again we meet among the board to hear what we have heard before. Our correlated lesson manuals now are all complete,